Welcome to the Small Batch edition of Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here in historic Studio 44 on this Monday morning with two members of our team from NPR Music, Stephen Thompson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
And with us is Jacob Gans. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Linda. How are you guys doing?
We're good. You guys both burned the midnight oil on Sunday night covering the Grammy Awards while I went to bed early and caught it later on my DVR, as I think many people did. I want to start off by covering kind of the big news, which is the major awards. Jacob, how did the major awards go down?
All of the major awards went to Adele.
So what did Adele win exactly?
Adele won Album of the Year for her album 25. She won Song of the Year for her song Hello, and she won Record of the Year for her song Hello. Record of the Year is an award for the recording, and Song of the Year is for the songwriter. So it was the best written song of the year and the best recorded song of the year, according to the Grammys. It's not the first time that Adele has won all of the major awards,
yeah,
by the way.
Right.
In 2012, when 21 came out, Rolling in the Deep won, 21 won. Everybody at that time kind of expected,
yeah,
Adele to win everything.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case this year.
Well, I think it's safe to say that Adele's album was probably, undoubtedly, the most culturally discussed album of the year, wasn't it? Was it not, Stephen?
This is clearly, these were awards without controversy. I didn't hear anybody on my Twitter feed arguing at all with the fact that Beyoncé's Lemonade, which was, in fact, the album of the year, did not win album of the year.
Yeah.
And that Formation, an amazing song, which frankly had a lot more. If you talk about recording, Jacob, you talk about songwriting versus recording. I mean, Formation is a beautifully recorded song. I mean, Hello is a much more kind of classic pop composition.
This is a thing that the Grammys just sort of like are going to have to deal with at some point in the future. They probably should have dealt with it 10 years or 20 years in the past, but it's really like staring them in the face at this point. There are 12,000 Grammy voters. Clearly, like a large number of them don't understand the difference between recording something like Formation and recording something classic like Hello, which is as classic as a pop song in this era gets. Adele is, she's safe. She's the one that they understand and the one that they love and lean on. And even Adele at the end of the night really could read the room and knew that she was winning something that was not going to sit well with a large part of her audience.
My artist of my life is Beyoncé in this album for me. The Lemonade album was just so monumental, Beyoncé. It was so monumental and so well thought out and so beautiful and soul-bearing, and we all got to see another side to you that you don't always let us see, and we appreciate that, and all us...
Adele is not only the safest choice, but also by far the best-selling choice. And the Grammys, they are music industry people. They are very excited about the fact that Adele is an artist for whom people still buy records. And I mean, you said to me, Jacob, at one point, that Adele has outsold Beyoncé by like 10 times as much?
Yeah, I mean, Adele sold over 5 million copies of 25 when it came out in 2015. She also outsold Beyoncé's Lemonade last year in 2016, the year that Lemonade actually came out. Adele sold over 1 million copies of 25 in 2016 on compact disc.
Wow.
I mean, like, the degree to which she appeals to an older audience, to a more traditional audience, to a vanishing audience, I mean, really cannot at all be overstated. She's appealing to a group that overlaps heavily with Grammy voters.
You also have to acknowledge that this is also part of this incredibly fraught relationship that the Grammys have with race that's,
yeah,
been talked about over and over and over again. There's a whole history, and I commend to you a piece in the Washington Post by Chris Richards this morning that talks about Adele beating Beyoncé and thus the Grammys reaching peak irrelevance.
Mm.
And it talks about this past history of, you know, folks like Beck and Mumford & Sons beating artists like Beyoncé and like Kendrick Lamar.
Losing to Macklemore.
I mean, there's a whole long, grody history of this. And I think that Adele is conscious of that history,
right,
and the fact that her winning isn't just, I liked this other record better. It taps into this entire history that we talked about extensively on an episode we did with Gene Demby a couple years ago that was more focused on the Macklemore sweep of the rap categories,
yeah,
that year.
Macklemore, by the way, did not submit his latest album to the Grammys, I think exactly because of this. After he beat Kendrick Lamar, he apologized to Kendrick Lamar and then forwarded that tweet or that text message on,
yeah,
Instagram to the rest of the public. But I mean, this is the thing that I think sensitive musicians and, you know, fault them for other things, if you will, but sensitive musicians do understand that Grammy voters don't. When you spread the voting out as wide as the Grammys do, you're going to get safe bets. You're going to get votes for musicians that the voters haven't actually listened to, but yeah. like, right? They feel comfortable with them. And, you know, this was another case in that sort of long, unfortunate trend.
Yeah. And for who votes on the Grammys, yeah, for people who aren't aware?
People who are eligible to vote for the Grammys are members of the Recording Academy who have to have credits on 6 releases. So they're producers, they're engineers, they're musicians
session musicians.
Once you have those 6 credits, you can vote for a very long period of time. I think there are ways to fall out of eligibility. But, you know, the number of musicians who are voting is, you know, they're not all extremely active in that community. And there are a lot of emeritus voters as
right.
well.
Right, right.
I think that one thing Adele may have been conscious of is that the Grammys are one of the few awards shows that can actually hurt careers. There used to be this kind of best new artist curse. But you also have had cases. I think the Grammys in the long run were not great to Macklemore's career. I would definitely say the Grammys were not great for Mumford & Sons' career. I feel like Mumford & Sons fell off a cliff as soon as they won Album of the Year, that there was enormous amount of backlash about that award.
Yeah, and I think when you are trying to get at the dynamic of the Grammys, one of the most interesting things to look at is the difference between who's winning those major awards and who's performing. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about some of those performances, because Adele did perform. She performed both at the beginning, and then she performed the George Michael tribute, which she stopped and restarted, which I thought was an interesting moment.
It was a very interesting moment. And I mean, this really does speak to the difference between 2012 for Adele and 2017 for Adele. In 2012, Adele flubbing something, Adele needing to retake something would really, I think, have been seen as a moment of charm and realness and something that people embraced in the room. And you could tell that even though the room was being supportive of her when she stopped that George Michael tribute a minute in and asked to retake it and swore on stage and apologized for it, it felt like she was a human up there, but it also felt like people were a little bit like, okay, you've had time to get this right.
Yeah.
Please just get it right.
Yeah. Well, and I think she has her own kind of ambivalent relationship sometimes with performing and with public life. I've had that sense from her before. So she did perform. Beyonce also performed, let us discuss, in a kind of a big epic performance that I felt like she was really embracing and centering her pregnancy and her pregnant body.
I also thought even the song selection in that performance was a little bit unusual and unexpected. She picked the 2 least discussed songs on Lemonade. She did Love Drought and Sandcastles, which kind of form that middle part of the record that people sometimes forget. I even thought that choice was pointed. You're my lifeline and you're trying to kill me. If it wasn't me, would you still feel me? Like on my worst day. Am I not thirsty enough? I don't care about the lights or the beams. Spend my life in the dark, but it's like you and me. Only way to go is up. Skin thick, too tough. Cause you, the physicality of that performance, while visibly pregnant, was very powerful. At one point, she's tipped way, way back in a chair, and you're like, the union that is in control of making sure that this chair does not break.
That nobody drops Beyonce.
This is, like, what is the insurance
not
company?
Not just Beyonce.
Yeah.
She has 3 hearts.
I know.
Like, what? How much money is literally, like, hanging in the balance?
Right. But also that performance, and I think everybody is going to be looking for, rightly, a lot of kind of art historians to expound on all of the imagery from that, as people did with Lemonade, all of the imagery that she was using and employing, a lot of which is going to be more familiar to some viewers than others. So I am looking forward to kind of the annotated versions of that performance.
Yeah, I mean, the halos that she and her dancers wore, I mean, were straight out of sort of medieval portraiture of saints and the Virgin Mary, which, you know, like, she doesn't do anything by accident.
Yeah.
Beyonce
yeah.
doesn't do anything by accident.
Right.
I think that's the one thing that we can definitively say. The fact that she lost those awards at the end of the night was, like, the only thing of the night when she appeared on TV that she could not control.
Yeah, I agree. And the other thing that I thought was so interesting was that her embrace of kind of talking about pregnancy and motherhood, which is really the theme of that performance, was also for me underlined by the fact that her daughter was there and was having such a good time, like jumped in on carpool karaoke.
Was
singing
by far
Sweet
the best
Caroline.
Part of carpool karaoke.
Absolutely. But that kid, to me, looks so happy and kind of unself-conscious in this way that I find delightful. And I think it's really interesting to see not only the motherhood centered in the performance, but also just the personhood of Blue Ivy.
Yeah, I'll step back and say the actual best part of Carpool Karaoke was after Carpool Karaoke ended and James Corden announced that Bruno Mars was performing next. Her face lit up like a normal six-year-old who gets to see Bruno Mars perform on stage.
Let's talk a little bit about Bruno Mars. Bruno Mars did both a Bruno Mars performance and then did the Prince performance, which was sort of, to me, a really cool performance, but was also essentially like Prince cosplay.
I think in his early years, and he played on a lot of award shows in his early years, and I viewed him as like the head of the Bruno Mars Rock and Soul Review for cruises. I just thought he left me absolutely cold. And I think over time, he has become a more vibrant and interesting performer. But when he's brought in to perform Let's Go Crazy, it kind of reverted a little bit to what bothered me about his early performances. I think especially coming after what was to me this incredibly welcome appearance by The Time, doing Jungle Love and The Bird, two songs I love. I've been watching you. I think I want to know ya. Know ya. I said, I'm a little dangerous. Girl, I'd love to show ya. Show ya. My jungle love. Oh, we are, we are. I think I want to know ya. Know ya. Jungle love. Yeah. Oh, we are, we are. Girl, I'd love to show ya. Show ya. Wait a minute. That to me, like, I was Blue Ivy. During that performance.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are two reasons you get Bruno Mars to do that performance. One is that he never misses a beat. That guy hits all of his marks, whether it's his songs or whether he's doing somebody else. And let's remember that Bruno Mars began his career decades ago as a child Elvis impersonator. So, like, he's in this game playing other people's songs for a really long time. But he's the guy you want to have up there if you want to not screw up the Prince tribute in a lot of ways, right? Like, if you're goal is to not mess it up, Bruno Mars is your guy. But the other thing that I think that Bruno Mars does in that role is he underscores something that a lot of people forget about Prince, which is that Prince is not just the celebrity figure, not just the incredibly magnetic person up on the stage, but he was also an incredible musician.
Yeah.
Prince sings, plays all the instruments on his recordings. And I think that for Bruno Mars, that's a moment where he gets to say, I can sing, I can dance, I can actually play the guitar up here. He's not doing it on the same level that Prince was, with the same magnetism that Prince did, but he's the next best thing, which is not a kind thing to say about the performer who you have all the eyes on, but he's the next best thing.
I enjoy watching Bruno Mars a great deal, particularly because in shows like this, he is a reliable source of not just what Jacob said, which is kind of meticulous execution, but also joy. And the other performance that I wanted to talk about in terms of not exactly joy, but I think high energy, is this performance from A Tribe Called Quest that everybody was talking about that also involved, so it involved them and Busta Rhymes and Anderson .Paak and Consequence. You want to kind of give a little bit more of the background of this performance, Jacob?
When Tribe was announced to play, they threw up a tribute immediately to Fife Dog, their fallen member who died last year. They played snippets of a couple of songs of their classic hits, and then went pretty immediately into just the most blatant political message of the night. By far. But, like, no contest. Anything else that had seemed political up until that point was revealed to be sort of, like, a shade of political.
Yeah. Jennifer Lopez sort of saying, like, yeah, we Katie should
Perry.
All get along.
Katy Perry, like, ending her performance in front of the preamble to the Constitution. Busta Rhymes comes out and says, thank you to President Agent Orange for your failed Muslim ban, which was shocking. They, like, literally break down a wall to begin the performance. And Q-Tip ends the performance with his fist in the air saying, resist, 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 after performance of We the People, a song off the new album, which is all about exclusion and government that's hostile to many Americans. It's, I mean, like, there was not a moment where you thought that they were pulling any punch at all.
Yeah.
All of the bad folks, you must go. Dark skin, high yellow, you got to go. All of my poor folks, you must go. Still hustle every day, ain't making no dough. And all of the Mexicans,
Dominican.
You are scored.
Doesn't mean if you're Chinese or Filipino.
Muslims are gay.
You got some
boy, we hate your ways.
Just go away.
It was an incredibly vibrant performance,
yeah.
And that's one thing you sometimes miss when you watch a lot of these Grammy performances where they trot people out like Little Big Town, you have 40 seconds to perform, or Lucas Graham,
right.
You have to perform right before Beyonce, and right. You get this kind of flat somebody standing with a guitar behind kind of a sparkly backdrop,
right.
And this had theatricality and vibrancy and intensity.
Yeah.
Well, there's a difference, too, between this kind of theatricality and intensity and not to pick on her, because I actually think the song is kind of okay, but the Katy Perry song, which for Katy Perry is a political song.
Yeah.
It's a song about watching your country change and feeling like everybody is sitting back and pulling the wool over their eyes, which is for Katy Perry, somebody who's solidly in the center of American pop music, possibly a little bit of a risk. But that performance feels very workshopped and feels as out on a limb as she might feel like she is. She's still trying to sell those records. It's still the beginning of her album cycle. And you know that there are people behind her at the label and her manager and everybody who's saying you have to try to appeal to all of these people. And Tribe Called Quest made their record in secret.
And they're not
just
making
because
another
they
one.
Wanted, just because they wanted to, because they knew they had a thing that they wanted to capture. And they put it out when they were ready to, which people have been waiting 2 decades for, by the way. And they have nothing to lose by doing this, because this is exactly the reason that they made the record.
So another performance that I just want to touch on real quick before we go is Chance the Rapper, who won some Grammys last night.
He won Best New Artist, which is the first award of the night. He won Best Rap Album and I think Best Rap Performance.
Okay. And he also had a performance that what I thought was so interesting about it was that I was curious about whether the Grammys have ever showcased such an overtly Christian-themed performance outside of perhaps a specifically Christian genre like gospel. Do you know what I mean? There was a choir. He talks about God all the time.
Kirk Franklin comes out, who is just a giant of gospel music.
It was amazing to me.
Yeah, it underscores the difference between somebody like him who has explicit Christian themes in his music and somebody like Sam Smith, who performed with a choir when he was nominated a few years ago for Stay With Me, but he's just performing with a choir because it's really cool to have a choir on stage with him, right? Like, Chance seemed completely at home with those singers behind him. And, you know, that was praise music from the first note.
I do not talk to the serpent. That's how this thing discerned me. Daddy said I should determine me. So many goofy can't hurt me. I do my baby so empty. I got that time like real early. I'm making statements worldly. Wish I could tell you it's ready today. But they don't get nothing away. You gotta fight the old way. But that don't take nothing away. Cause at the end of the day, music is all we got.
And you can, of course, find tons of clips of all of this stuff online floating around, at least for now.
Before
and,
the ghost of Prince has it all taken down.
Absolutely. And so thank you guys for being here to talk about this. This is really fun.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Full episodes of Pop Culture Happy Hour are available every Friday at npr.org or on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.